my favorite story was about when Michael Hutchins came in and helped me get the CDs from the top of the closet. I thought I was going to actually die on the spot because he had so much charisma and was so charming and so sexy. I thought I would literally just like melt on the spot.
That's Dorothy Carvello, the author of Anything for a Hit, and welcome to Rock Conversations. I'm Rob Bob. Dorothy, more than just being an author, started her career in the music business as an assistant to the legendary Ahmet Erdogan, head of Atlantic Records. She has great stories, some which may surprise you, about Ahmet Erdogan. She exposes the underbelly of the music business. Now, some of you probably think, well, music business, the record business, of course it's slimy. Of course it's filled with a bunch of scumbags. Dorothy takes her expose to a whole new level. She's fascinating, and let's get to it right now. Our rock conversation with Dorothy Carvello.
Oh, let's go back, let's go back, let's go back again.
So I'm wondering, given all the music business connections to, shall we say, organized types of businesses, organized crime, how are you still alive after dishing all the dirt you did on the music industry?
Well, I think that's a romantic notion. One thing about the men that I wrote about, one thing about the men in the music business, they're, how could I put it? They're basically pussies. They're not tough guys. So they're fake tough guys, to say the least. And also, I wrote my book. I received not one legal letter, not one lawsuit. My book was vetted and cleared legally. And the statute of limitations for the fighting in court has long passed.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Ahmet Erdogan was a huge part of your life.
Yes.
I don't know where to start with him. Let me ask you this. I mean, as I was reading the book, I thought back to something Father King told us in Zom Hall at Notre Dame. He said once during a homily, he said, a cynic is a person who knows the price of everything and the value of nothing. And I wondered at times reading, was Ahmet not necessarily cynical, but would he have fit that description where he seemed to know the price of everything but didn't value certain things?
I think that he just... two things. First, he was a sociopath. Other people didn't register into his, day-to-day life. It was just all about him, his needs, his wants. So sociopathic tendencies, narcissism, even though he was born a Muslim, he did not practice or believe in God. So when you have that type of personality and everybody enables you around you and you get away with everything and nobody tells you anything's wrong, you know, you have a monster is created. And because you have talent and power, even though you abuse both, there was nobody like him in the music business. You know, he was a unique personality.
What do you think? What certain traits made him so different than other people in the music business?
Well, first, he was born into a wealthy family of aristocracy. His father was he was the Turkish ambassador to the United States. So he was born of privilege. He was a foreigner. He had different notions and ideas. Money was not his motivation. He never bought a pair of shoes off the rack or clothes off the rack since he was a child. So he was, almost like a prince or a king or lived that life of royalty. So he just loved to have fun, had a great sense of humor, and he had an amazing idea and the talent to back up the idea to make a successful record company. So that makes him unique from the others, where he really discovered the most amount of artists than any other person, more than Clive Davis, more than anybody himself. You know, he walked into a club in England, discovered Eric Clapton at age 15. So story like that after story after story from every genre of music, R&B, rock and roll, the British Invasion, to Laura Branigan, all different types of music. So I think that's pretty unique.
It's very unique. One thing that astounded me reading your book, by the way, we're talking with Dorothy Carvello. Anything for a Hit is the name of the book. It's a fantastic read. I wasn't surprised by the use of substances in the music business. I was surprised that Erdogan could get up and function and live as long as he did. I mean, it was like Superman or something.
Correct. I think he could out-drink and out-party anybody. I think some people just have that constitution, and it is amazing that he lasted that long doing the amount of drugs and alcohol that he did on a daily basis and smoked cigarettes.
Yeah. Yeah. Here's one thing that kind of surprised me, and maybe I hadn't done a good enough research, but in the David Geffen documentary on American Masters, it makes it seem like not only was Ahmet his mentor, but that they were best of buddies the rest of their lives. You depict quite a different relationship and one that was, among other things, fairly competitive once David Geffen started to make it big.
Yes, very competitive. And also, Ahmet was David Geffen's mentor. But Ahmet, I mean, I didn't work there at the time when Geffen started, and Ahmet funded the label that he opened up, Asylum. They used to let him sit in the hallway, David Geffen, for hours and hours until they would let him in to see Ahmet. Ahmet, you know, would fuck with his head. But Ahmet was insanely jealous that Geffen made the transition to movies. And Ahmet never did that or could do it. You know, he didn't have the concentration or the drive at that point to do it. But also Geffen copied the art collecting from Ahmet. So he was a mentor to him, but Ahmet was, you know, viciously competitive and envious of, you know, Geffen's talents in terms of movies and, you know, that sort, being like a Hollywood. You know, Geffen's really surpassed Ahmet in other areas of the entertainment business, which killed him.
Oh, one connection to Geffen, who you know well, is John Kalodner.
Yes.
I think you were told to stay away from him. It's almost like a parent banning their child from seeing somebody. Ahmet said, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, he was also crazy because Kalodner worked at Atlanta at one time, which I didn't know when I first met him. So that's really, and then left, you know, the thing is, Doug Morris and Ahmet Erdogan, they had a thing. If you left Atlantic, you were a traitor. And they really believed in that. And like, you were banished pretty much for life. So Gardner left and went on to have great success at Geffen Records. And also David Geffen treated his people like human beings, not slaves. He paid them a great money. He bonused them. He regularly bought them gifts. And the A&R people there were given, they really had autonomy. They didn't have to answer really to David Geffen. I mean, they did. They answered to Ed Rosenblatt. But they were allowed to do what they want and spend the kind of money that they wanted to develop back. So they were given much more creative freedom. So Ahmet hated him too because he went on to be successful. And David Geffen made a lot of money from the, you know, records that he did. And they also participated in a point structure, you know, some of the sales, profits from sales, where at Atlantic, we were not allowed to participate in that.
You started working at Atlantic as one of Ahmet's assistants. When did you decide that you really wanted to be in the A&R department to go out and try to discover and sign artists?
Well, I started as secretary, A&R, the head of A&R's office was directly across from mine. So they would have meetings in there and it seemed like a good gig because you got to go out, you got to meet all these celebrities, you got to go to concerts, you got an expense account. So I pretty much made up my mind when I started my friendship with Jason Flom. I heard how they found talent, how they listened to music. So I kind of like began to be on the hunt for that kind of stuff. And I had access to Ahmet and Doug Morris. So it was kind of like a natural development. And I hated being a secretary. I couldn't type or take dictation. So it was hard. you know, it was a harder job for me. You know, basically I was a phone operator. I had no freedom from 9 a.m. till 9 p.m. And I had 30 minutes for lunch, chained to a desk answering the phone. So I, you know, that sounded great to me.
Yeah, I think that, you know, 9 to 9 with a short break and having people yelling at you might get old pretty quickly.
Yeah.
You mentioned throughout the course of the book, I think on a few occasions, you talk about someone from your Catholic school upbringing, Sister Rose Ellen. What sort of impact and how did she influence your life later, you know, when you were at Atlantic or elsewhere in the music business?
Well, I think Sister Rose Ellen, I admired her because she was what I called a progressive nun. You know, she was enlightened in terms of the way that she taught. She didn't wear a habit. She was tough for a woman. Not tough in the mean way, like people are afraid of nuns, they're going to hit you with a ruler. She was tough, and she also saw, she could see you as a child and identify your personality strengths. And, you know, she said that I could be a leader. She also had tremendous morality. And I think that for me, Catholic education was so important to me because I really came from, you know, my mother had a lot of morals, and that influence of Sister Rose Ellen to go to college, you know, she pushed me to go to college where most of my classmates, I think it was just one other kid and I went on to go to college. And that was a big influence because in those days, education was everything. And if you went to Catholic school, you not only got religious training, you also received a better education than if you went to a public school. You know, you were pushed more you know, you got more homework, more amounts of things, and they pushed you. So to see her really as a nun where they're, you know, lower in the church than a priest, you know, she worked her ass off. And ultimately, sadly, when I went to go find Sister Rose Ellen again to tell her about this book, she had just passed away.
Oh, no.
Yeah, but she went on to be a guidance counselor and also a principal.
So let's run through just some of your favorites in different categories, if we could, from your days in the music business. Who are some of your favorite artists to work with?
My favorite artist to work with, God, Jesus. I think one of my favorite artists, if not the favorite, was Tori Amos. I worked with her. I didn't sign her, but I worked with her. I was smart and fun and just really sang her ass off. She didn't need a lot of direction. She knew what she wanted. So that's always enjoyable. To me, I don't say in the studio process that when I would work with artists and everything, for me, it was, I don't want to say painful, but it was difficult. And even today, when I listen to music, I don't listen to it like a consumer. I listen to it as a person that, so I would have to say off the top of my head, Tori Amos would be my number one pick, even though I didn't sign her. Skid Row was good in the studio. They really knew what they wanted and they were fun. They were a lot of fun. You know, had a lot of fun.
Yeah, when you say it was painful at times with other artists in the studio, is it they didn't know what they wanted, they couldn't, or you didn't like what you heard, or their work ethic?
It's a combination of both. You never want to tell an artist that something isn't good or something isn't great because it's their art and they should be allowed to do it. But at that time, we had to give everything, had to have a commercial outcome, you know, where that's not necessarily the reason why you sign an artist. You sign them to develop them to make a commercial, hopefully a commercial outcome. So, but we were under so much pressure. Everything had to be a hit. That's why I named my book Anything for a Hit, because that's what they wanted, the bosses wanted. That's what kept the company going. And nobody really, sadly, wanted to develop artists for like, sometimes an artist can't make it right out of the gate. They need 2 or 3, even 4 albums before they're ready to go for what would be a big commercial success. And we were not allowed to really develop anybody like that. So
Let's go back to favorites. And again, this is, I'll admit, I'm the king of asking unfair questions. So in your illustrious career, to ask you to pinpoint a few favorites is probably really unfair, but I'll ask you anyway. Do you have a favorite concert experience or two?
You know, I loved all these rock and roll bands. I mean, I loved Aerosmith. We give a great concert. I loved Aerosmith in concert. I loved Bon Jovi in concert, Skid Row in concert. I mean, I still go to see them if they come and play. Manowar, I could last maybe three songs because they were so incredibly loud that even, you know, would just blow your ears out. Who else do I love in concert?
I think we've all been to a show like that once or twice, haven't we, where it's so loud.
You know, the heavy metal stuff is really, really rough. I love Cher in concert. You know, I love to be entertained. I love a good frontman. I loved NXS in concert. They were great. You know, I love a good front guy.
Do you have a favorite office story, either good, bad, or ugly?
Every day was a favorite office story. I mean, I had the job where when my boss would come in at 3 o'clock in the afternoon every day, even though we'd be working on the phones in the morning, you know, anything could happen. He could be drunk, fall on the floor. You'd walk in, he'd have his fly open, his pants down. Let me see. One day, there were three senior executives, Ahmed Erdogan, Doug Morris, the president, and the COO, Sheldon Vogel. In one afternoon, they all had their flies open.
Oh, boy.
Bob Morgado, who was the corporate, Time Warner corporate chairman of the whole music group, they had to have a meeting with them. And I came into the office, and they were all sitting there with their flies unzipped. So I said, "Your flies are unzipped," and Bob Morgado's coming down. So everybody said, "Thank you," except for Ahmed said, "How do you know?" I said, "Well, your shorts are hanging out through your zipper." So it was be like this kind of dysfunction. But shit like that happened every day. So, but my favorite story was about when Michael Hutchins came in and helped me get the CDs from the top of the closet. I thought I was going to actually die on the spot because he had so much charisma and was so charming and so sexy. I thought I would literally just like melt on the spot.
So, and if I recall, did someone come in and insult you from the company? Tunge. And he had your back. Michael Hutchins had your back, right?
Yes, he was a gentleman. Tunge Erim, who was the head of A&R and was my boss later when I went into the A&R department. He was so vulgar and disgusting. You couldn't even invent this guy. So he was always insulting me, pinching my ass, making inappropriate comments by anyone's standards at any time standards. So yes, Michael defended me. And that was great. That one of the few.
Now, help my memory here. I think when you first met Michael Hutchins, NXS had not yet exploded. They were still kind of up and coming and they needed a little boost. Was it MTV that gave them the pop over?
Yes, that was okay. They didn't explode really in America. They had a huge following though, but that album Kick that came out in, their single came out in September of 87 and then the album in October, that took them to the whole US level. They were already huge all over the world, which is happens to a lot of bands. But at that time, bands always wanted America because it's a huge market for album sales and also recognition. So
we are speaking with Dorothy Carvello. I'm glad you got married, by the way, because I'm not sure I could have pronounced your maiden name.
Well, that's I still go by. I never changed my name legally, but professionally, I started to use my ex-husband. But it's not really. If you're Italian, it's easy. It's Cicignano, but it's, you know, not easy. It could have been Sorrentino.
Sounds better than it reads.
Yeah. I used to argue when my parents were alive all the time. How did we get this name?
I don't want to dwell too much on Michael Hutchins and we can leave out the sordid details, but the two of you,
there was nothing sordid about it.
Okay. I think you connected in a certain way. Was it in Lake Geneva?
Yes, Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, the most obscure place. That's where we were making Skid Row's record, and In Excess was on tour promoting Kick. And you know, it's amazing. In the warm months, they do the sheds. And there was a venue. I can't remember it off the top of my head, but it is in the book, close by there. And that was the best hotel, so that's where all the bands would stay. So that's where I first hooked up with him. But I always had a relationship with him for those 10 years that I knew him before his death. And, a lovely, lovely man. A lot has been written about him that is incorrect. And, you know, he's a cautionary tale of what this business can do to you, and how we prop up people and we forget that they are people. They're not gods. And we don't pay attention to the mental health of artists in this business. You know, we grind them out for money. And he's actually going to be the subject of my next book. But it's going to take place, instead of being Michael Hutchins, he'll be a country music artist set in Nashville.
Is this the work of fiction that the New York Post referred to
recently?
It's going
to be reality. Yeah, reality fiction. Yes.
Okay. Let's talk about... what do you call them? Lucky criminals. I think a whole chapter in the book. Listen, you know, I've been a music fan and consumer, never really involved in the music business. I worked at an FM station once where we did have some albums that had the, you know, little clip in them or clip taken out of them. I never knew what it was. Some of these stories just boggled my mind, how the artists would literally have money stolen from them, royalties stolen from them. And it seemed to be standard operating procedure.
Correct. It's a federal crime. It's a violation of the RICO statute, and everybody went along with it. And the managers back then, when there was physical products sold, the amounts of money, like you would buy, remember when CDs came out? I started just as they were converting albums into CDs.
Right.
So a CD was like $12.99. Anywhere from $12 to $15 for one CD. Well, the math on it is that to make that whole product, put it out with marketing and everything, it costs the record company about a dollar. Let's say it's $13. So
you're making $12 on a CD at that time. Correct. That's pretty good return.
Correct. So albums, all of that stuff, that's an unbelievable return. So they would... There was so much cash involved. The record company would say to them, oh, what does it matter? You're making millions of dollars. It doesn't even matter. It won't even affect your bottom line. And it didn't. So they would go along with it, but they didn't even really grasp the amount of physical product, albums and singles. You know, singles used to be sold as albums. They didn't grasp the amount that they were pressing up. And then, you know, clipping out, you could walk into Sam Goody's. If you buy the $5 one, it's got a little drill hole in it. Who cares? It's $5. That money, the retailer would give back to the company in a scam. You know, maybe I don't know how much the retailer would keep for distributing the product because I didn't work in sales. But, you know, they would pocket. That's a lot of cash. You know,
I was really surprised reading that. And I think you said that certain managers, I think those associated with Led Zeppelin and maybe the Stones as well, actually demanded an audit. But I was surprised more managers didn't do it because, you know, the manager's job obviously is to oversee the business. You don't expect the artist to be that involved.
Correct.
So I was a little blown away. Yeah,
it is surprising. And here's the thing. The managers are making so much money that they don't care. You know, they're not doing the business of the artists. And that is a fact. And a lot of managers know a lot of shit and they don't give a shit about the group. You know, I mean, there was a time, I don't really want to say who it was, but there was a group out there on the road making millions of dollars. The manager's off playing polo, calling up, oh, what's the receipts from last night? It's human nature, sadly. Everything is about everybody themselves. Nobody looks out. So I often wonder, why do groups even have managers? You know, everybody's in on it to a certain extent. And if a manager's making millions of dollars, they aren't watching the store. And those contracts and royalty statements to this day to artists are ridiculous. You can't even read them. It's just crazy. So this whole business has to be, even now, overhauled and changed. And it's not fair to artists. And artists really need to be more proactive in their contracts when they sign them, and really vet their manager and see that they're going to be on top of everything.
I want to get your thoughts on one of your favorite managers. I say that with a smile on my face because I don't think he is. But when Irving Azoff, let me rephrase that. When the Eagles were inducted into the Hall of Fame, I think it was Don Henley who thanked Irving. He said, he may be Satan, but he's our Satan. And right. You took a different approach. I think you call him the poison dwarf.
Yes. Yeah, so that was his nickname in that book, Hitman. And, you know, I always say, I laugh because the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this past year, I guess, inducted Irving Azoff. They gave him the Ahmet Erdogan Award. So I like to say that's like giving the Adolf Hitler Award to Lucifer. So.
Yeah, I don't think. And what was the deal with you were making a deal with Irving and then his wife didn't like you or something? It seemed a little petty, or was he just stealing the idea?
No, I mean, the record I signed, I brought to Irving after I was fired from Atlantic for refusing to sit on my boss's lap and writing a memo about it to the president of the company. I needed a job desperately. I had no money. So I found this record called Hold You Tight by Tara Kemp. And it was on an independent label called Big Beat. I met Irving Azoff on a trip to Hawaii I took with John Klodner. So I knew who he was. And he just opened up a label called Giant that was distributed through Time Warner, the same label that Atlantic owned. So I called him up and he said, sure, send me the record. I played him the record. He said, it's a hit. I want it. He said, I'm going to hire you. He gave me a consultancy, but I didn't have a contract yet. He was waiting to get a place for me at work. And then when the record went to number two, he fired me. I received no money. None of the promises that he made me, shocking, ever materialized. And the guy that gave me the record, Irving wanted him to come work for him. His name is Craig Kalman, who's the current CEO and chairman of Atlantic Records. I brought him to Doug Morris and said, go do a label deal with Doug, being the lesser of two evils. But I believe that Doug Morris, who was such great friends with Irving, was annoyed that I had a hit record and they just fired me because they're petty, petty, very petty men. And they perceive you as an enemy if you don't do toe the line what they want. So, and
does Doug, it extend? Is it both when they're being petty, or are they targeting you because you were female, or are they just petty in general? Gender doesn't matter.
I think both, but I think the fact that I was the only female and I didn't go along with the shit. When I was fired, even from Atlantic, the woman in HR told me I should apologize to Doug Morris. I didn't go along with this culture of this sexual abuse, and I hated it. And what I spoke up about it, I was penalized. Other people went along with it. Other women went along with it. They had careers, but I got really, after a while, every single guy, every single day with a comment in a meeting, it prevents you from thinking clearly, from doing your job. It's humiliating. It's upsetting. I mean, you shouldn't have to go to work and have your skirt pulled down, be called these types of names. And I challenged Doug Morris. He was president of the company and he let me know, you know, I fucked with the wrong person. And he was the most powerful man in the music business.
Now,
so
you do,
he
yeah,
wasn't
going to
let
share,
me get away with that.
Yeah, you do share some stories about arguably good people in the business. Randy Goodman, I think, is one of them.
Yeah, Mr. Goodman, who's the chairman of Sony Music Nashville. Look, here's what I like to say, and I kid with Randy Goodman. The bar is set very low, so don't get too pumped up. But he was the better of, you know, the guys. I mean, he didn't use foul language and, you know, he didn't touch anybody or do that type of shit. Atlantic was really the worst worst of the worst, where all the men did it. You know, it was a culture.
Now, you said before, the music industry, even today, needs some reformation of some sort from an accounting standpoint.
Correct.
Is it as seedy? I know you've been removed in some respects from it for a while, but is it as seedy with the behavior, the sexual comments, the skirt lifting, the ass pinching, or has the Me Too movement kind of taken care of that?
No, we've had no Me Too movement in music business, and I intend to change that. First, my book is going to be made into a documentary.
Oh, great.
Yes. So that I'm just started working on it now. And I intend to bring the Me Too into the business because as a result of my book, hundreds of women have reached out to me about men in the music business currently running companies that are abusers. And some of the stories are so horrific. They range from executives to artists to girlfriends of people. It's a disgrace. And what I want to do is I'm opening up a foundation, and the foundation will be a resource center for women to come and tell their stories and get some kind of help. And also get, I want to be able to refer them if there is some kind of a legal case, refer them. And I also want to change laws. Of course, we were trying to do it in New York this year, but the legislature didn't go for it. Adult to adult sexual abuse law, like they did with the Boy Scouts and the Catholic Church. They did that child to adult. But if we get an adult to adult sexual harassment and abuse law passed in New York, since what happened to me, I would have a valid legal claim against the Warner Music Group and against the estate of Ahmet Erdogan for sexual harassment and abuse, and some other men as well. So that's what we want to happen, because we have hundreds of women. And I believe once I start to go into the media, when I'm announcing, I haven't announced my foundation yet formally, but when I do go out there and announce it formally, I'm going to be inundated with even more. And we have the, EDM world is filled with where drugs are used. And I've had to hear stories from women ranging in ages from 22 to I'm 59 to my age. So if I have to sit across from a 23-year-old telling me the same shit is going on that happened to me, then there has been no Me Too. There has been no change. The culture is the same. They'll argue, I want to change the culture. The companies will come back and say, it's a few bad apples. We'll get rid of them. It's all bullshit. Maybe she has to sign an NDA. Maybe she gets a little bit of money. Maybe not. I did not. And the man stays and then gets recycled, like the Catholic Church when they move a priest who's a pedophile.
I was going to say there, what you're describing bears horrible similarities to what the church did for years.
Correct. And the culture in the church hasn't changed either. You know, they're still covering up to a certain extent. So to change an institution's culture takes a lot of work. And right now they see it as NDA women, man stays. I'd like it to be if a man has a proven, the case has to be proven, has to be investigated, a sexual harassment claim that has been proven, he goes and the woman stays. There has to be a safe place for women to go, and HR is not doing it. And the stories I know about current men right now in the music business are shocking, appalling, and disgraceful and illegal. And these companies are not being held accountable for the behavior of their executives.
As we wrap up in the final few minutes here, let's go back to Ahmet Erdogan. As you look back at incredible, both good and bad, an incredible experience. What stands out from a positive standpoint working with Ahmet? Well,
the just being in the presence of a great man in terms of his craft and, having that influence to have him as a mentor in the music business and to roll with him. I mean, people read about him, and now in college, there's these classes about him and everything. And I got to see him, and it taught me to understand that when somebody is great at something and they're revered, they're still a human being. So for me, everybody that I ever met in the music business and know the things I know in the music business all stems from me being Ahmet Erdogan's secretary. It was an invaluable education that people ask me about him all the time. What was he like? What did he do? And he was just, he was remarkable in so many ways. And, and then you had his personality, which till this book, I don't think many people knew really what he was like. You know, his drug abuse, his abuse of people, his temperament. People really didn't know that. Because if you met him at something, he would be the most charming person in the world that you would meet. But, you know, there was a whole other side to him. And that's true of many people that do great things.
The book is Anything for a Hit. The author is Dorothy Carvello. It's been great chatting with you, and we'll certainly look forward to seeing the documentary.
Yes, well, stay in touch, and I'll let you know when that's coming.